Look ahead. Imagine more. Gain insight for your industry with forward-thinking advice from the professionals at CohnReznick. Is your business ready to break through? Find out more at CohnReznick.com/breakthrough.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I had an absolutely fascinating and fantastic conversation with a rock star professor of neurolinguistics and cognitive psychology and all sorts of other interesting fields of study within the world of cognition and psychology, Professor Steven Pinker at Harvard University. This guy is a rock star. This was really one of those conversations that was just so fascinating and went in so many different directions. He's a psychologist, but he also has a really fascinating quantitative background. And so he's a guy that's actually especially driven by data. When you think of things like neurolinguistics or visual cognition, you don't think in terms of how's the math behind this. But he has a mind that looks at the world very much through a quantitative filter. He wrote a number of, by the way, won a ton of awards at Harvard and throughout the sciences. Highly, highly regarded. His books have are also really, really well reviewed, very notable. The book Better Nature of Our Angels: Why Violence Has Decreased Around the World. And indeed, when you look at it quantitatively, violence and war and crime are at record low levels. I know it doesn't look that way when you see the news, but that's a fascinating conversation. I love that sort of counterintuitive, here's what everybody believes, it's all wrong, here's the data and proving it. And he brings that approach to everything he touches. His work on how the mind works is really fascinating. How children acquire language skills and why that is a significant evolutionary development amongst humans is really, you know, groundbreaking, fascinating stuff. You may not think that there's an immediate application to the world of investing, but he's just one of these people who are so interesting and so knowledgeable and has such an interesting model in his mind for how to approach thinking about the world that I can't help but think that there are lessons for investors in this. So a little off the beaten path, but absolutely fascinating. Here is my conversation with Professor Steven Pinker.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is Professor Steven Pinker. He is a rock star professor of cognitive science and psychology at Harvard, where he holds the title of Johnstone Family Professor in the Psych Department. He is a psychologist, linguist, and popular science author specializing in visual cognition and psycholinguistics. I think you're going to find a lot of what we talk about today absolutely fascinating. He's won numerous awards from the National Academy of Sciences, the Royal Institute, the Cognitive Neuroscience Society. He is the author of The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Better Angels of Our Nature, The Stuff of Thought, and most recently, The Sense of Style. He is also on the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. Professor Pinker, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you.
First question I have to ask you, what is visual cognition and psycholinguistics?
Those are two subtopics in the field of cognitive science, which is how do we think? What is the nature of intelligence? Visual cognition is how we interpret what we see or how we think about what we see. How do you recognize the face of a friend? How do you find an object when you're rummaging through a drawer? How do you imagine things that that are hypothetical, like what would my living room look like if the couch was on the other side, or what would this molecule look like if I rotated it in three dimensions? How do we allocate attention across the visual field? How does your airport screener look for the hidden weapon in those false colors colored X-ray images and so on.
Or not find them in 95% of the cases.
So we have learned. Yes. Indeed. So that is a problem in visual cognition. It's not vision in the sense of seeing color and motion and sharp detail, but it's the next step up in the brain, namely how does the visual world interact with what you know, what you see, what you think about.
So that raises an interesting question. How much of what the average person perceives as a 360-degree construct of the universe around them, how much of that is accurate and how much of that is the brain filling in, projecting, I don't want to say fabricating, but filling in the blind spots and blank spaces? Is what we see actually there, or maybe not so much?
Well, when we're not hallucinating and we're looking at something, then we can see things vertically, and we do it much better than any robot or artificial intelligence system. That's why it's taken Google so long to develop a self-driving car. They're trying to bring it to and exceed the level of a human visual system. On the other hand, there is an illusion that we have a wall-to-wall tableau of visual detail, mm-hmm. And that is constructed by the brain. Because even if you hold your hand out maybe 8 inches from where you're looking, mm-hmm. you can't even count the fingers. Your vision, the right. acuity of your vision falls off really dramatically, but your eyes are constantly flitting around. And so your brain kind of constructs an illusion of a continuously detailed visual world. But outside the fovea, the spot that you're actually looking at, vision is surprisingly coarse, and we rely on expectations and memories.
I picture hundreds of listeners holding their arms out and saying, you know, I can't count how many fingers I have.
And it doesn't have to be in your peripheral vision. It just has to be a few inches away from the direction of your gaze.
So when people talk about tunnel vision or hyperfocus, really that's the normal state of...
There's a sense in which we all have tunnel vision. We don't realize it because our eyeballs move around so quickly.
Huh.
And then psycholinguistics, that was the second half of your
yes.
question. That's another topic in cognitive science, and that is the psychology of language. How do we understand speech? How do we produce speech? How do children learn their mother tongue? Where does language come from? Who decides what the rules are? How does it change over time? How do we read? All of those are topics in psycholinguistics, the psychology of language.
So I don't remember which book it was. It might have been The Stuff of Thought, or it might have been How the Mind Works. You talked about how words sometimes are onomatopoetic, and it just made me think of the Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner routine, The 2,000-Year-Old Man, where they discuss how egg and shower are onomatopoetic. And I won't spoil it. People should go find it on YouTube. It's hilarious. But how much of actual language is because things sound like the way they are?
Yeah, a bit. And so it's not a complete coincidence that, say, the word mellifluous
is so mellifluous.
And the word cantankerous reminds you of a person with a lot of sharp edges. On the other hand, that only goes so far, because if you could really predict what a word meant by what it sounded like, then you wouldn't have to go through the laborious process of learning a second language. All the words would be, the meanings would be obvious. So most of language is arbitrary, but there is a little bit of correlation between sound and meaning.
So I just got back from Europe, and I know most of what you've worked on has come out of the English language, but why is it that when a non-speaker of, let's say, French or Italian listens, it sounds so melodic? Or if you listen to German, it sounds so harsh and guttural. What is it about those languages that give those things that sensation?
Well, it's a component of language called phonology, the sound pattern of the language, and that includes the set of vowels and consonants that you're allowed to use. We don't have ch in English, but
right.
you have it in Hebrew and in German. It also includes the melody and rhythm of speech, what's called prosody.
Prosody.
Yeah, so that's huh. kind of the aspect of language that you can hear behind a closed door.
Mm-hmm.
And you can often recognize a language just from its
yes.
prosody.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Professor Steven Pinker. He teaches at Harvard in the psychology department, studying cognition and psycholinguistics. One of your more recent books was called The Better Angels of Our Nature, How Violence Has Declined. And when you see the data on this, it's pretty It's pretty astonishing. In the preference to better angels, you say, the present day we are blessed by an unprecedented level of peaceful coexistence. But that seems to be contradicted by the news headlines we see every day. How do you reconcile the two?
Because you can't get an accurate picture of the world by looking at the headlines. The headlines are about things that happen. They're not about things that don't happen. And as long as the rate of violence hasn't fallen to zero, there are always going to be enough violent incidents to fill the news. And we can lose sight of the vast amounts of the world that that are at peace. Currently, there is a zone of war that stretches pretty much from Nigeria through sub-Saharan Africa into the Middle East and then down into Pakistan. But 5/6 of the world is at peace. And areas of the world that were torn by war for centuries haven't had a war in decades. Western Europe, one of the most historically violent parts of the world, hasn't had a war in 70 years. Southeast Asia, those of us who grew up remembering the war in Vietnam.
Sure.
Yes, and there has not been a war in Southeast Asia since a small skirmish between China and Vietnam in the late 80s. And it isn't just war. It's also one-on-one crime, which actually kills more people than wars in most years, other than in world wars. But the rate of crime has gone down. Everyone knows that it's gone down in the United States, but it seems to have gone down globally as well, especially if you look at even earlier periods in the history. The Middle Ages, the rate of homicide was about 35 times what it is today. So that was an even more dramatic decline, and it's homicides that kill the majority of people.
So you mentioned the Middle Ages. In the book, you describe the six major historical declines of violence. Let's skip ahead to, I think it was the third or fourth decline, which was the invention of the printing press and the spread of literacy. Why is that so impactful on reducing violence?
Well, it's a conjecture. The phenomenon we're trying to explain is why there was a cascade of humanitarian reforms around the time of the European Enlightenment, the second half of the 18th century. Also, of course, the time of the American Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights, which was a kind of product of the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Why did people wake up in the 18th century and say, well, maybe we should stop burning heretics, or maybe we should stop executing people for stealing a cabbage? Maybe slavery isn't such a great idea when you come down and try to justify it. Maybe we should stop watching animals tear each other apart for entertainment. Maybe we should stop throwing debtors in prison. So all of these reforms concentrated in a few decades. And we have to ask, why then? Why did it take people millennia to figure out that might be something a wee bit wrong with slavery? And so first hypothesis is, well, maybe people got richer. And if your life is more pleasant, then you value life more generally. And so you value the lives of others. But the timing doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because people only started to get rich, other than the kings and aristocrats, in the 19th century.
Right.
And these reforms were really products of the 18th century. So I've suggested that maybe it's the rise of literacy and printing and the exchange of ideas. And that was the only technology that showed an increase in productivity prior to the Industrial Revolution. The cost of printing a book plunged in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of an early version of Moore's Law, if you look at the cost of producing a book. More and more people were reading. There were bestsellers. There were novels. There were also pamphlets in the first newspapers. So the world got more connected. People could exchange ideas. Bad ideas could be criticized.
Mm-hmm.
People would get together in cities, in coffee houses and pubs and salons to exchange ideas. And it's possible that, first of all, that could increase your circle of empathy. It's harder to dehumanize people when you read their words, when you see what life was like from their point of view. And also, when you have ideas being brought together and people debating them and arguing them over them, then bad ideas tend to be filtered out. So the idea that the reason that there was a crop failure is because of witchcraft, for example. The reason that there was an epidemic is because the Jews poisoned the wells.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery is a good thing because Africans can't do anything but be slaves. All of these toxic ideas could start to seem ridiculous when you know more about the world. And that was conceivably accelerated by the exchange of printed matter.
So education helps reduce violence by making people less likely to believe silliness and nonsense and more likely to understand basic science and the logic of this causes that, not witchcraft.
You know, on average, over the long run, not in every case, because there have been toxic ideas that have been advanced by intellectuals. Communism, for example, responsible for massive numbers of deaths, was an intellectual movement. And Nazism, there were plenty of Nazi professors. But I think that when you have freedom of speech, freedom of expression, so you don't get thrown in jail by criticizing a bad idea, then it's more likely that the bad ideas will be exposed. And it's not a coincidence that repressive regimes are also repressive in clamping down on free speech.
So we've seen a huge decrease in crime and violence in the United States over the past 30 years. Some people have attributed it to things like the ending of lead paint in apartments. Other people have looked at the removal of various additives to gasoline, taking the lead out of gasoline. The guys from Freakonomics even have gone so far as to suggest Roe v. Wade is a factor. Why the huge fall off just in the most recent few decades?
Yeah, so starting in 1992, there was an eight-year decline of violent crime in the United States, which brought it down to almost half of its peak. And then, surprisingly, around 07, 08, there was a second decline, which no one predicted. Everyone said, well, we have great recession, unemployment, crime's going to go up, inequality, and crime went down instead of going up. The honest answer is no one really knows what all the causes were. Probably the cute theories, like lead in the gasoline, abortion, are wrong. And it may be that a number of things went right around the same time. Among them were an increase in the number of police and a change in police tactics, so policing got smarter. Nationwide, the homicide rate absolutely plunged, and rates of other types of crime like rape and assault and robbery also went down. Then there are also changes that no one really can completely explain in the culture, because you also had a decline in teenage pregnancy, a decline in insurance fraud, a decline in drug use. So somehow people got a little bit more civilized starting in the 90s on top of these other changes.
So last question, you've noted that the economic benefits of affluence, really a post-19th century phenomena, did not have a big impact on violent crime. Well, why do you imagine that is?
Well, it didn't have an impact on institutionalized violence, on slavery, on grisly torture as a form of criminal punishment, like breaking on the wheel and burning on the stake, hundreds of capital crimes on the law books. So it was really
meaning crimes that there was a death penalty for, but did not involve homicide.
Exactly. That's right. Criticizing the Royal Garden, being in the company
of
gypsies.
Well, wait a second. You can't. Listen, I understand some of these other things, but if you're going to criticize the Royal Garden, that's it. Get the wheel out.
You don't deserve to live. Right.
Horrible. That's amazing that that was a capital crime.
It is amazing. Well, England had 400 capital crimes on the books in the prior to the 19th century.
So the affluence didn't affect the institution.
I think affluence does affect certain kinds of violence. So, for example, countries that are at the rock bottom end of the poverty scale, that make less than $1,500 GDP per capita, are much more likely to have civil wars.
Sure.
Although once you climb above that level, then there isn't a clear relationship between civil war and affluence. But certainly rock bottom poverty is a contributor to civil war. In general, but not always, it's the poorer sectors of society that are more crime prone. So there is some relationship, but it's not a perfect relationship.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Professor Steven Pinker. He is professor of cognitive science and psychology at Harvard, author of numerous books, winner of numerous awards. His most recent book is Sense of Style. And let's talk a little bit about the way people communicate today with the written word. What's the impact of the digital realm on writing?
I don't think there's a simple answer to that, because there isn't one thing called writing. And when people, it's a question I get a lot. Well, now that people are writing 140 characters for Twitter and instant messages and emails, isn't the language going to deteriorate? And the answer is no. because we don't just write in tweets or in instant messages. We all command a variety of styles for different formats. We don't speak the same way when giving a lecture as we do speaking to our family across the dinner table. A text message is going to be different from a funeral oration. And so just looking at one kind of writing and saying, well, that's what's going to happen to the language in general, just isn't valid because we tailor our language to the medium.
What about technologies like PowerPoint and the tendency for people to try and communicate by numbered bullet points?
There's good PowerPoint and there's bad PowerPoint.
Okay.
In science, 100% of scientific presentations are done in PowerPoint.
Mm-hmm.
Science has not shut down or even slowed down. It's, if anything, accelerating. And PowerPoint, by mixing text and images, can be and video and audio, can be remarkably powerful. We've all sat through horrific PowerPoint presentations,
yes,
where just banalities are broken up into bullets. But it's like writing and saying, like, what does print do to the language? Well, there's a lot of drivel that people write down, and there's a lot of brilliance that people write down. But the PowerPoint medium opens up huge possibilities.
Sturgeon's law applies to everything. In other words,
exactly. Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about how vocabulary and grammar of English have changed. What drives these changes, and how much has the English language changed just over the past century?
It hasn't changed so much that you can't understand writing that was set down 100 years ago. You know, if you have a look at a copy of the New York Times from 1916, and you can understand pretty much all of it. But it feels different. The style was more formal. There's been an informalization of style that might parallel the informalization of everything else. The fact that gentlemen don't wear ties everywhere, and that women don't wear white gloves. The fact that we refer to each other on a first name basis instead of Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so all the time. And writing has gotten more casual as society has gotten more kind of democratic, or at least the look and feel is more democratized. And vocabulary definitely turns over. If you look at an episode of a contemporary show that was set in the past, like Downton Abbey, linguists have often had a field day at flagging all of the idioms and figures of speech that just didn't exist in the 19-teens,
right,
that the writers kind of anachronistically put in. There's a lot of turnover. A lot of it is kind of random. There's drift in and out. People, an old saying will just sound fusty and old-fashioned, and younger people will stop using it, then they'll introduce new figures of speech. And so there's a constant turnover, which is why if you go back more than 100 years, say you go back to Shakespeare, it's not often not that easy to understand what the references were because the vocabulary is obsolete.
One of the things you wrote in the book that I thought was quite interesting, many of the alleged rules of writing are actually superstitions. Explain what that means.
So many of us have been under the impression that one ought not to split an infinitive. So instead of saying, as Captain Kirk did, to boldly go where no man has gone before, you should say to go boldly where no man has gone before. That's a perfect example of a superstition. There's absolutely no reason to avoid a split infinitive. The whole rule came from a kind of thick-witted analogy to Latin, where you can't split an infinitive. But there's absolutely no reason to avoid splitting.
Ending
infinitive.
A sentence with a proposition.
Exactly. So you know, Shakespeare wrote, "We are such stuff as dreams are made on." You going to go tell Shakespeare that he made a grammatical error?
Absolutely not. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Professor Steven Pinker, professor of psychology and linguistics at Harvard University. Let's jump into some of the really fascinating things that you have written about. There's one that really struck me. Let's go start right off on the wonky linguistical things. What's the difference between common knowledge and shared knowledge? Because they seem so similar.
Yeah. Shared knowledge is when you know something and I know something. Common knowledge is a term from game theory and logic, is when I know something, you know something, I know that you know it, you know that I know it, I know that you know that I know that I know it ad infinitum.
Right.
And that makes a difference. It makes a difference in logically. There's certain things that you can deduce if something is commonly known. That is, you know that I know that you know it. Mm-hmm. And it makes a difference, I think, in our everyday lives. When we have an expression like the emperor's new clothes, what are we referring to? When the little boy said the emperor is naked, he wasn't telling anyone anything that they didn't already know. They could see the emperor was naked. So why was it such a big deal? Well, at that moment, everyone knew that everyone else knew that everyone else knew that everyone else knew that the emperor was naked. And that allowed them to challenge the emperor's authority by breaking out into laughter.
But before the little boy said that, people didn't realize that they had a shared knowledge of his lack of clothes.
There could be a little scintilla of doubt. You know, I can see it, but how do I know that everyone else can see it? And how do I know that they know that I know? And that makes, by the way, it makes a difference in technology, especially for what they call network externalities. Mm-hmm. That is when the advantage of a technology depends on everyone else using it. And so to generate a network externality, you need to generate common knowledge. And the best example, this is from Michael Chua, is when Apple introduced the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. Back in 1984, I think it was the most expensive commercial ever made. They introduced it in the Super Bowl.
Played once, directed by Ridley Scott.
Exactly. The famous 1984 commercial. Now, the thing is, no matter how good a computer a Macintosh is, no one is going to buy it if they think that they're the only one buying it, because there won't be enough software, there won't be enough peripherals. Right. You have to know two things. You have to know, number one, it's a good computer. Number two, everyone knows that everyone knows that everyone knows that it's a good computer. And that's why you had to introduce it with something that made a splash, that you knew when you were watching the Super Bowl that the whole country is watching the Super Bowl.
Right.
And so you knew that this product was going to be, its advantages were going to be common knowledge as opposed to shared knowledge.
So it's more than just the network effects, like a fax machine or what have you. It's the network effects plus everybody recognizing that this is now in
widespread use. That's how you create the network effects.
Okay.
You have to generate common knowledge. And the easiest way to generate common knowledge is if there's an event that everyone can witness while knowing that everyone else is witnessing.
And the Super Bowl is a perfect example of that.
That's why the ads in the Super Bowl get almost as much coverage as the Super Bowl itself, because that's where companies that introduce a product that depends on a network effect will introduce the company. Monster.com is another example. Might be a great employment site, but who's going to go there unless they think that employers are advertising jobs, and vice versa? Who's going to advertise there unless you know that people are going to be looking for jobs? And so you make a big splash on a Super Bowl ad.
Let me continue along surprisingly interesting things. Why do we have facial expressions, and what functions do they serve?
Yeah, it's not just to, you might say, wouldn't it be best to keep a poker face and not to, not to show your cards? Facial expressions can signal the credibility of a threat or a promise. And in a study that I did with Ian Reed and Peter DeSciole, we found that threats are more credible when they're delivered with an angry expression and tone of voice. Because they are involuntary, unless you're a really, really good actor.
They're perceived as sincere.
Because they are sincere in most cases. People aren't that good at controlling their facial expressions.
So we've seen, I've read about other studies where they look at people smiling, and apparently an actual smile involves the eyes and a fake smile just involves the mouth. And on a subconscious level, people can see and tell the difference. Am I telling that right?
When the flight attendant says bye-bye with the grin pasted on her face, you know that she's not actually experiencing joy. And it's usually because the sincere smile is the one with a crinkling of the eyes, not just the mouth in a U shape.
So this combines both the visual cognition and the language aspect of this as well, doesn't it?
Indeed. And speaking of common knowledge, which we discussed earlier in the program, why do people blush? That's a puzzle that I've thought about. And I think that, which unlike other facial expressions, which are conveyed by contracting muscles, with blushing, you've got this rush of blood to the face. And I think it's because it generates common knowledge. That is, when the thing about blushing is you When you blush, you feel it from the inside,
yes,
and you display it from the on the outside, and you know that everyone knows that you're blushing.
Right.
And in fact, when someone says, you're blushing, that makes it all the worse.
Right.
You blush all the more beet red.
So it's genuine and sincere, and both parties understand what it means.
Exactly. It's I messed up, and I know that I messed up, and I'm not trying to pull anything over on you. I'm not a psychopath. I'm not a cheater. I have the same standards that you did, and I know that I messed up, which is a way of knowing that the person is less likely to mess up in the future if at least he recognizes that he messed up.
So blushing, embarrassment is an acknowledgement of common ethical standards? Is that how,
yeah,
or common morality? Am I misstating that?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Common norms, that's right. But in particular, the common knowledge in that technical sense of, if I'm blushing, then not I know that you know that I've messed up. And that means that I, by blushing, I'm acknowledging that I'm playing by the same rules.
So I mentioned morality and ethics. One of the columns you had written, I think it was for the Times, talked about three people: Mother Teresa, Bill Gates, and Norman Borlaug. And if you were to ask various people, who's the most admirable of these three people? Who is the most has had the greatest impact on humans? Most people get the answer to that wrong.
Yes, I mean, the common answer as well, you know, Mother Teresa, she's a, you know, a saint. She's the most, in fact, if you ask someone, who is the most moral person of the 20th century, they would say, oh, I guess Mother Teresa. But now you think, what exactly did she do? I mean, you know, she washed the feet of some, you know, lepers and brought them
helped
in and
the
let them
poor
let them
and
die.
All these things,
well,
right?
Help them. I mean, how did she actually make them less poor?
Temporarily, for a meal or two, but...
For a meal or two. But then you look at Bill Gates, and I used the example at a time before he became famous as a philanthropist.
Right.
He was just starting the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's trying to conquer infectious disease in the developing world with the chance of improving the lives of tens of millions of people, of saving tens of millions of lives. Then Norman Borlaug I threw in because no one's heard of Norman.
That's a fascinating, so I never heard of him.
Who the hell is Norman Borlaug? He won the Nobel Peace Prize for inventing the Green Revolution in the 1960s, developing crops and methods of farming that multiplied the amount of food that an acre of land would deliver. He's credited with saving a billion lives, more than anyone in history, and no one's heard of him.
He wins, and yet is totally unknown.
So what it shows is that our sense, that our own ascription of morality, who we revere, who we don't care about, who we even revile. And by the way, the other reason I chose Bill Gates was at the time that he was associated with MS-DOS and Windows.
Which everybody hated.
Which everyone hated. And so everyone hated him. He got someone threw a pie in his face. There were I Hate Gates websites at the time. So our ascription of morality, who we give brownie points to, is very loosely related to how much good they do in the world. And it's actually a quirk of our own nature of who we admire. I think it relates to who we would like to have on our side in our foxhole, part of our community.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't really closely related to how much good they do in the world.
So if people want to find more of your writings online, in addition to all your various books, where's the best place to send them?
StephenPinker.com is my website that has links to all of my articles, as well as to pages for each one of my books.
If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and stick around and listen to our podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue to chat about all things cognitive and linguistic. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Are you looking to take your business to the next level? The accounting, tax, and advisory professionals from Cohn Resnick can guide you. Cohn Resnick delivers industry expertise and forward-thinking perspective that can help turn business possibilities into business opportunities. Look ahead. Gain insight. Imagine more. Is your business ready to break through? Learn more at CohnResnick.com/breakthrough. Cohn Resnick. Accounting, tax, advisory.
Welcome to the podcast, Steve. I don't want to call you Professor Pinker, Steve. What, Steve?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for doing this. This is really I love this stuff. I find it endlessly fascinating. And anytime I can weave cognition into what investors should be looking at, thinking about, and just stimulating their thought process to develop better mental models and better processes to approach this stuff, I think it's just fascinating. And it's, your work is so diverse that you're obviously fascinated by so much of this. It's apparent in everything I read of yours.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me on.
Well, it's been my pleasure. There are some questions we didn't get to before I do my standard questions, but some of these I just have to come back to. So in the 1950s, comic books were going to turn juveniles into delinquents, and what happened subsequent to that?
Yeah, the 1950s was a decade of very low crime.
And then the 1990s, same thing. Video games were going to cause people to become ultra-violent.
Especially the first-person shooter games. It's easy to imagine how that might happen, but it didn't happen. That was the era in which crime plummeted.
And then, in general, television, transistor radios, rock and roll, music videos were decades where people were supposed to get stupid.
That's right. And actually, IQ scores have been increasing for decades, the so-called Flynn effect. Although crime did go up in the 1960s, and it stayed high from the 60s through the early 90s. So not all of the people who said that when rock and roll was coming in, that they would lead to a breakdown of order and safety, weren't completely wrong, in that there was crime shot up by a factor of more than two.
So it was rock and roll. It wasn't an ill-considered war in Southeast Asia. It was music.
It wasn't rock and roll, although it wasn't. The war in Asia probably didn't lead to a rise in street crime in the United States either.
But it did lead to. So what I remember New York City in the 70s was a disaster.
Yes.
What led to a breakdown in those basic societal norms of not robbing and killing and raping? How does that go off the rails?
Yeah, again, the honest answer is we don't know for sure, but a number of things happened. The baby boomer generation reached its crime-prone years. In the 60s. That wasn't enough to explain it. That would explain why violent crime would increase by 15%. Violent crime, in fact, increased by 150%. Mm-hmm. But it may be that having a whole generation coming of age at the same time kind of overwhelmed society's defenses.
Sure.
And it was a time in which there was
civil unrest, a change in rights. There was a whole bunch of
things. And a general, you know, we grew up in it. There was a decline in respect for authority. The police backed off. Mm-hmm. There is some truth to the explanation that the criminal justice system was less likely to put people behind bars.
What about the broken window thesis? Do you buy into any of that?
There is evidence that the broken windows effect is real. That is, if a neighborhood shows signs of disrepair, the famous broken windows, graffiti, turnstile jumping, and so on, then that conveys the message that this is a place where the rules are not enforced. And there's some experiments that show that increasing the general appearance of order leads to a decrease in the rate of crime. It doesn't deserve all the credit, but it may deserve a part of it.
I find that fascinating. Let me see what else I skip through. Oh, let's talk about the long piece. When we were talking about From Better Angels, the various six phases of decrease in violence, what exactly is the long piece and what was the cause of it?
Long piece refers to the fact that war between great powers, the 800-pound gorillas of the world, has kind of stopped. The last one that we had was in 1953 with the end of the Korean War, with the United States on one side and China on the other.
But was that really a U.S. versus China, though? I mean, I know there were a lot of proxies, but it wasn't like World War II, where Germany and Russia and U.S. and Japan were literally doing battles with each other.
Well, there was a coalition that the United Nations authorized, with, of course, the United States contributing the most troops and weaponry. And, of course, North Korea had its own army, but supported overtly by China, and with the USSR definitely helping, although not sending troops. But through most of history, the great powers were always at each other's throats. And then after World War II, that kind of went out of style, as did wars between developed states, that is, rich countries. We think of war as something that takes place in the poor, backward parts of the world. But it used to be that it was the rich countries that were constantly at war, and that has gone out of style.
What do you credit for that?
And wars between countries in general. Most wars now are civil wars. Mm-hmm. Wars between
intra-country
countries. Intrastate war as opposed to interstate war. And a number of things. One is that the world has become more globalized. When there's more trade, there is less of an incentive to go to war. You don't kill your customers.
Or your supply chain.
Yeah, or your supply chain, exactly. You don't. If it's cheaper to buy things than to steal them, then you don't. You're less likely to plunder and invade. There's been with the United Nations, there has been a norm that borders are pretty much grandfathered in, so you don't push borders around by force. You don't swallow states. States are now considered to be immortal. They can break apart, but they can't be swallowed by their neighbors. There is more democracy, and on average, democracies are a little bit less likely to wage war, at least on each other. And I think there's more of a respect for human life, the idea that you should die for your country, that it's glorious and sweet and the best thing that you could do. And conversely, that leaders can sacrifice millions of their own young men for the glory of the empire is less in operation now than it used to be.
So before I get to my favorite questions, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about the debate over gene editing. If for people not familiar with CRISPR, there's been a huge number of articles, most recently in Wired magazine, describing how this has made what was once time-consuming, complex, and expensive, very inexpensive and relatively easy to do. What does the advances in biotech say about current morality, and why are some people on one side or the other of that debate?
There's a widespread fear that first popped up when Dolly the sheep was cloned in 1997 and has been revived now with the development of CRISPR-Cas9, making it easy to edit genes, that we'll be designing our own children very soon. We'll put in the gene for musical ability or athletic ability or high IQ. I think that's very unlikely. Mm-hmm. I think it is possible that you could edit out disease genes, but having looked at the genetic basis of personality and intelligence, I can tell you that there ain't no IQ gene. There may be 1,000 genes, each one of which raises or lowers your IQ by a tenth of a point. Mm-hmm. But the single gene that's going to give you musical talent or athletic ability just doesn't exist. That's just not the way genes work. There is a genetic basis to talent and personality, mm-hmm. but it seems to be distributed across hundreds or thousands of genes, each with a tiny effect, many of which may have side effects. That is, there may be a gene that increases your likelihood of being smart, but also slightly increases your rate of having bipolar disorder.
Right.
Or of some kind of degenerative disease. So I don't see parents taking the chance with their children anytime soon of mucking around with the embryo by putting in a few genes, each of which might increase the IQ by a tiny fraction of a point, but might also introduce some risks.
So I'm glad I brought that up because I've read some of the pieces you've written on that and thought it was interesting. Let me get to my I know I only have you for another 10 minutes or so, so let me get to some of my favorite questions I ask all my guests. So your background is really kind of interesting. Did you know you always wanted to be a professor? Did you always want to go into teaching?
I certainly enjoyed teaching from the time I was in college. I put myself through college by tutoring high school students in math and science. For a while, I thought, gee, maybe it'd be fun to be a high school math teacher. But my mother, among others, convinced me that university was really the place for me, that adding to knowledge as well as transmitting knowledge was seemed to be what I enjoyed doing.
Nicely done, Rose. Next question, early mentors. Who were some of the people who mentored you and gave you intellectual direction?
As an undergraduate, I was a student at McGill University and was in the psychology department there. And I worked in a lab of a cognitive psychologist named Albert Bregman, who studied auditory pattern perception, how the brain makes sense of the world of sound. In university, one of my advisors was Roger Brown, the great social psychologist and founder of the study of child language acquisition in children, and a gifted writer. And I think I took lessons from him on writing, how to try to write stylishly. Stephen Kosslyn was my mentor in visual cognition. He's now the academic dean of Minerva University, a startup university based in San Francisco.
It's an interesting group, and it seems you took something from each of those folks and
One more is Joan Bresnan, who is a linguist at MIT at the time. She was a student of Noam Chomsky's. Mm-hmm. And she was my postdoctoral advisor.
Ah, there you go. That's quite a list. You reference Chomsky quite frequently in many of the books. Obviously, he is a leader in this field. My next question is, what are some of your favorite books? Whether it relates to language and linguistics or anything else.
Well, Noam Chomsky was my colleague at MIT for 21 years, and mm-hmm. he was in a different department, but he was certainly an influence from the time that I was an undergraduate, particularly his books in linguistics. Language and Mind was a book that I read as an undergraduate. I certainly don't share his politics, but nor do I subscribe to his particular theory of how language works, but he broke open the field of language and really deserves credit for the modern understanding of language.
Any other books stand out as whether it's fiction, nonfiction, related?
Well, I'm married to a novelist, Rebecca Goldstein, and her mm-hmm. book, The Mind-Body Problem, I read many years before I met her.
Remember
that old ad, the guy, Victor Kiam, who got a shaver, he said, I liked it so much. I bought the company.
Right.
Well, I liked the novelist so much that I married her.
That's very, very funny. So since you really started in psycholinguistics and visual cognition, what are some of the major changes that have taken place in that industry or that field of study, I should really call it?
Certainly the rise of neuroimaging, functional magnetic resonance imaging, was revolutionized the field.
Being able to see what part of the brain lights up in response to different stimulus, different processes, is that specifically what you're referring to?
Exactly, yeah. And that has been the single biggest change.
And how does that manifest itself in the study of language?
Well, you can see how words are processed in the brain. You can see how grammatical processing is implemented. That is, by grammatical processing, I don't mean rules like avoiding dangling participles.
Right.
I mean just ordering words in a way that makes sense, what we do every time we open our mouths and produce a sentence. And you can see also the pattern of information flow from one part of the brain to another, because it's not as if one blob of the brain is responsible for all of language. There is, you have to coordinate your understanding of what words mean, your knowledge of English syntax, the control of the muscles of your tongue. In conversation, you go back and forth between speaking and listening, so it also involves hooking up speech information coming in from the ear. You have to hold things in memory. As you start a sentence, you have to know where you're going. So a lot of different parts of the brain are involved in language, forming a kind of network. And neuroimaging helps you see the different parts of the network and how they interact.
I recall reading about aphasiacs and other physical damages to the brain. How important is looking at damage, physical trauma, and disease to learning about language? Is that something that we did decades ago and figured out, oh, this injury causes this result? Have we moved beyond that? Or is that still a key part of recognizing how these brain components develop?
It still is a key part. It used to be the only way that you could understand language in the brain. Now it's still important, even in the era of neuroimaging, because neuroimaging tells you what is active when you are engaged in a task, but it doesn't tell you what's necessary. For all you know, it could be like the lights that flash on a computer. That
right.
is, you turn off the lights, the computer still does its thing. It's kind of a spillover effect. And you never know just from the fact that blood is going to a particular area of the brain whether that part of the brain is necessary for the person to do what they're doing. With brain damage, you're removing a component, or nature is removing a component, and you're seeing what they can no longer do. So it's still a supplementary form of information and an important one.
So you work with a lot of college kids, people who are just starting out their career. When a millennial or recent graduate comes to you and says, I'm thinking about a career in linguistics and visual cognition and in any of the subsectors of psychology that you focus on, what sort of advice do you give them?
If you're passionate about something, and if you can see yourself throwing yourself into it, doing a lot of work, then you should pursue it as a career. Even if the academic job market is discouraging, which of course it is, it has been at various times, such as when I was a student, and I remember the advice that I got from Ronald Melzack, a professor of psychology at McGill, pioneer in the study of pain. He said, look at the bright side. People die. People retire. People get higher paying jobs in industry. There's always turnover, even if the mm-hmm. market is contracting. If you think you're good at it, if you're willing to dedicate yourself to it, if it excites you enough that it doesn't feel like work, but it feels like play, there'll always be openings. And so I tell students, if they're really passionate about some intellectual topic, not to just automatically go into law or finance or consulting, because that's the easy path, but that it really is still possible to make a career in what you love.
And our last question is, what is it that you know about cognition and linguistics today that you wish you knew when you started 30 years ago?
I think that any cognitive or psychological trait both has a heritable basis, but is distributed over hundreds or thousands of genes, that there is not going to be a gene for X. That there's a lot of information that can come out of looking at large data sets, that you're understanding of a subject is only as good as the data that you can examine, and that to understand something, you've got to look at as large a set of data as you can find.
Professor Pinker, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. This has been just absolutely fascinating. If you enjoy this conversation and others like this, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch at any of the other 92 or so such conversations we've had over the past 2 years. Be sure to check out my daily column. It used to be BloombergView.com, but I am now seeing that it is Bloomberg.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank Taylor Riggs for being our booker, Charlie Vollmer for being our producer engineer, and Michael Batnick, head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening, or you've been listening, to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Look ahead. Imagine more. Gain insight for your industry with forward-thinking advice from the professionals at Cohn Resnick. Is your business ready to break through? Find out more at CohnResnick.com/breakthrough.